This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the publishing industry and its history, and as well, its present and its future. Today I'm talking to Tom Meyer, who is a poet and has been involved with the publishing of Jargon Society, a really incredibly important small independent publisher of literature, based principally in North Carolina, where Tom is today as I'm talking to him. Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm very well. Good to be here. It's great. Or be wherever we are.
Right, wherever we are. Well, we're sort of, at least electronically, we're somewhere, but it's hard to decide where.
I know.
Well, we've known each other a long time. So some of this is going to, you know, we may talk about personal things along the way or things that we both experienced, but, you know, Jargon was founded in 1951 by Jonathan Williams. And I guess we should give credit also to his co-founder, who was David Ruff, correct?
Yes, that was the first, really, really didn't extend much beyond that very first, book that was a poem of Jonathan's called something like Garbage Literature, The Vase of the Iron Child's Son or something like that. It was just a really just a folded card with a David Ruff etching and a poem by Jonathan.
And so, but principally Jonathan Williams, also a poet and who was at that time ended up going to Black Mountain College and studying with people like Charles Olson, who was there then. I mean, the press really revolved around Jonathan's interests principally for quite a long while. So the history of Jargon in the 50s and 60s was that it was fairly small and produced occasional pieces, but incredibly important books and broadsides for the most part, as we look at it today, by people who maybe then weren't so famous and today are incredibly well known. So, you know, since Jonathan's not here any longer to talk about that, maybe you could talk a little bit about what was going on at Jargon in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, I think so. I think the thing that really impressed me when I first met Jonathan, which was in 1968, and was that period from the 50s and 60s was a period, he was obviously a young man, and he published primarily people who, Kenneth Rexroth and Charles Olson were really his primary sources. They are actually like a, you know, like two completely different influences on him, and I don't think either one or the other really approved of the people he was publishing that weren't part of their stable, as it were. But and I think really one of the weirdly instructive things was that Rexroth had attempted to get James Laughlin to publish Denise Levertov's first book, which I think, first American book, which was Overland to the Islands. And Laughlin just couldn't see it, at least in typescript. So Rexroth told Jonathan to do it, and he published actually a very beautiful book. I mean, physically quite beautiful, because his primary interests were not primary, but his parallel interests were in bookmaking, typography, paper, binding, all of those things. And it was after that book came out that James Laughlin at the New Direction Press saw the poems on the page in type and scooped her up right then and there.
And that seemed to be, I mean, what you just described for the Levertov is kind of emblematic of what Jonathan was doing in those years and his
absolutely.
I mean, he would find people, his enthusiasms were irrepressible, but he, you know, his taste and interests were incredibly broad. I mean, when I knew him, which was much later, and I knew, you know, when you and he were together for all those years that, you know, the Jargon existed after the advent of, well, this, what we'd call the second period, where there was more support for it. But he was always been on the lookout, and always was on the lookout for people that really were unusual, that he responded to, didn't care whether anybody else did, although always in the, I think there was this subtext of irritability that so few people would respond. But I think he must have, I think he took a lot of pleasure in the way that people that he found were then subsequently published by others and gained larger audiences.
I think so. He did have, and you know, it was like a piece of DNA. His parents were very much the same, had this incredible ability, this radar to attach to something. In their case, it was things like European porcelains and antiques. But, you know, Jonathan was the same way. And instead of it being, you know, a piece of mice in China, it would be a poet that someone would put in front of him or have the poet send work to him. And it was, you know, I mean, it was an amazing track record in that sense.
And so in the during the 50s and 60s, and I remember Jonathan said to me once, you know, he would get in the car, print books, and his, as you said, his commitment to, or broadsides, but his commitment to the aesthetic of printing was really strong. And he learned a lot about typography and bookmaking and how to make a beautiful book, whether it was print or photography principally, or the, you know, the combination of both. But he would print these books in really small quantities, like 300 or something, and then put them in the car and drive around America, either, you know, distributing them in some way, whether it was selling them or giving them to people he thought should have them. And this seemed to be what he was doing throughout the 50s and 60s. Is that, I mean, am I right about that?
Yes, absolutely. But it wasn't just jargon books. It was City Lights. It was New Directions. It was all the small presses. And he used to get himself onto college campuses primarily, rarely in the English department, quite often in the architecture department and the design department, since those were his connections. When he left Princeton in, I think, 1950, it would have been, or 49, he'd gone there, I think, a year and part of another year, with the intention, I think, of becoming an art historian. But his heart was in painting. He had, as a teenager, been a painter, and I think it was definitely Kenneth Patchen who introduced him to the idea of text and image. And so he wound up at the Chicago Institute of Art, and from there made these connections in design and architecture. So he then went around to college campuses all over the United States and would present himself as someone to do an evening, and he'd give a reading, and he would read not just, and actually very in the beginning, very little of his own work, but read Duncan, read Olson, read Levertov, Rexroth, Ginsberg, the various people in that kind of very rich vein of the 50s of these small presses. I guess it's the beginning of the so-called small poetry press in the United States as we know it.
Yeah, and so was that financially? I mean, how did he support the press in that period?
He was not. These were unpaid gigs, really, it was primarily it was family support. I think he had not a lot of money from his parents, but he always had. Actually, the house that I'm sitting in right now was a summer home that his father built in 1942. And then his parents moved in about 1947, 48 or so, and suddenly made it a year-round residence. But he always had this as a place to come back to. So he didn't have a huge outlay of money, and he was very peripatetic in that he was driving around in this automobile. And I think in that period he must have, it's very strange, I recently found his father's checkbook and saw all these checks that were written to him when he was at St. Albans as a schoolboy. And I was just astounded at the amount of money he got weekly. It's about $100. This is in the 40s.
That's a lot of money.
So
what was
I think
he doing
that went
with
on
it?
That kind of support went on for quite a long time.
So he did that kind of explains to me. I never really understood how he managed in the 50s and 60s. But I guess, you know, a little family.
Well, he did, of course, not running around in the, it was a family station wagon. I think it was a Studebaker, one of those station wagons with the wooden sides that he had inherited from his parents and that he drove around. He did work at the 8th Street Bookshop as a book wrapper in the back, which was also part of being on the literary scene. And then he worked for, and now I'm not going to remember, a very famous record distributor in San Francisco in the 50s as well. And it really was one of those things. He also had, by the late 50s and into the 60s, he had obviously had valuable books. And so one of the ways he would raise money to keep going, and that continued to the day of his death, was to sell stuff that he had collected that had become valuable, really in terms of first editions and a little bit of artwork and photography towards the end of his life. But it was always a kind of hand-to-mouth existence.
Right, and so that kind of brings us to maybe the sort of turning point in a certain way for Jargon, which changed the way it operated, which you had mentioned to me earlier before we started recording, that Jonathan decided to make Jargon into a nonprofit in the late 60s. And this was, of course, you know, presaging something that happened later in the literary arts, but also in other fields where a kind of fugitive art form began to institutionalize in a certain way. And so Jargon probably was the first, I think maybe the first that I know of any independent literary press that became an official nonprofit, you know, gained 501c3 standing with the federal government, enabling it to receive charitable donations from supporters. I think you said it was 1968 when Jargon did that?
I think it was 68. What happened was a couple years earlier, probably in the about 63, Robert Motherwell, the whole time Jargon was publishing, it was also soliciting support, financial support, patronage, subscription, and the whole system of having a signed limited edition that would sell for $10 as opposed to $2.50. I think those are like the figures for the Maximus poems. He approached Robert Motherwell, and whom he had known from Black Mountain, and Motherwell said, and I think Motherwell at that time had a personal foundation or a foundation, and Motherwell said, well, you know, I'll give you $50, but you know, if you were a nonprofit foundation, I could write you a check for $500. So Jonathan set about setting up a nonprofit in about 1963 that was called the Nantahala Foundation. But the lawyers he was using were local lawyers who for them, nonprofits were schools or churches, and they couldn't see how a publishing entity could be a nonprofit. So that all fell through. But then in 1968, I think it was, could have been 67, but 68, the National Endowment for the Arts came into being. And Carolyn Kaiser was appointed the director of the literature program. And as part of the support for literature in the United States, she decided that, or someone decided, I think she was very instrumental, that small poetry presses should receive support from the government. And she selected, I think, about four presses, and now I can't remember who the others were, but one of them was Jargon. And one of the conditions for receiving the funds was to be a nonprofit foundation. And on the strength of that, and also a really high-powered double-barreled or triple-barreled law firm in Winston-Salem, were able to work the whole thing out, and there were obviously no problems there. If the federal government wants to give money to this entity, so this entity will no doubt qualify as a charitable institution. And that's the first grants were in 68, I believe.
And of course, once established as a nonprofit, that enabled Jonathan and you, I think when you were involved, you know, you spent a great deal of your time with patrons and very much in the vein of the, you know, the Renaissance artists, finding wealthy or, you know, professionals who had enough money to be able to and recognize the value of the literary art and the photography and art that Jargon was publishing. But that was, I think you spent a lot of time raising money.
Yeah, it was. And also, Jonathan spent, you know, every day. I mean, he's one of those people. Well, it's now hard to imagine, but I mean, people did it. Robert Creedy, Olson, anyone wrote letters all day long. And of course, a lot of those letters, Jonathan's were begging letters. But he had two principal patrons, Philip Haynes in Winston-Salem, which was the textile family, Haynes, and hosiery, but Philip was the other, the textile, and Donald B. Anderson in Roswell, New Mexico, who was in oil. And these are both people who just really, having met Jonathan in, again, sort of patronage situations, were really, I think, quite charmed by him and moved by his enthusiasms and really for, well, Donald Anderson was an extraordinary pillar of support up to today as far as Jonathan's legacy and Philip Haynes kind of veered off, but he was sort of pulling back from, he was very, very instrumental in the setting up of Jargon's charitable status and just the nuts and bolts of a board and board meetings and all of that kind of thing, which Jonathan really hated. I mean, went completely catatonic every year when that meeting came up.
Right. Those are the necessary difficulties. We won't call them evil so much, but, you know, for anybody who's, most poets and artists and sculptors and people, it's constitutionally difficult to engage in those kinds of activities. You know, it's just not part of what you really want to be doing.
It was very strange because his fear, apart from just the fear of being criticized for doing something, his fear was that the board would somehow curtail the activity of the press or influence it, which never happened. And I must say that everyone who has ever served on that board, no one at any point ever thought of suggesting anything other than the fact that Jargon had a tremendous success with the Appalachian photographs of Doris Allman in 1970, I think that was. And then, of course, the stellar success of White Trash Cooking in the early 90s, late 80s. And so what you got there is, why don't you publish another White Trash Cooking?
Right.
Which, again, that was anathema to Jonathan's idea of himself and what he was doing as a publisher. You know, so that, to go back to the 50s and the 60s, so that when Robert Duncan was picked up by Scribner's, Jonathan felt there's no reason for Jargon to publish him anymore. He's found a home. Same with Creeley.
Right.
In that kind of very extraordinary period in the mid-60s when the big publishing houses were publishing, you know, of all things, that sort of Black Mountain School of Poets.
That's true. No, I think that's important. That's a very big distinction between the aesthetic and the business of being a publisher, because commercial publishers automatically seek to replicate success. that's just part of their being. And so if they published a White Trash Cooking, the next thing a publisher like would do is either White Trash Cooking number two, or
which is what happened.
Right. Well, because and White Trash, I know we're jumping around a little bit historically, but I think I was the distributor at the time when White Trash came along. And so I remember that, you know, I was part of that whole event. And you essentially licensed it to 10 Speed Press, who went on to vast success. And of course, as we just said, would do sequels. And that White Trash, but I think I always thought White Trash Cooking was the most anomalous book ever published by Jargon.
It's very strange. When talking about Jargon and my relationship to Jargon is that I've always said, I never recommended any title to Jonathan. He would occasionally ask me, I read all the manuscripts and material, and he'd ask me my opinion. And the only book I ever recommended that he should publish was White Trash Cooking.
You get credit for being the one with a commercial eye.
Well, I had no idea that it would be as successful as it was, but when I read it, it was just so hilarious and so interesting, and those photographs and stuff, it just seemed, you know, and anyone who looks at it, you know, it pops, that's exactly what pops out.
Right.
So I can't give myself much credit for a nose in the business, as it were.
Well, no one gets credit.
It was extraordinary. And the irony of it was that it was a manuscript given to him by a patron, and it was one of those ho-hum moments. And so the photographs, which bought shoebox of photographs and then the manuscript, sat on his desk for about 6 months. And I sort of vaguely knew that this was going on and that he'd been given this material. And we were going to go to England in May. And he said to me, will you look at this stuff and tell me what we'll send it back, but just tell me what I should say in a letter, cover letter. I mean, he hadn't looked at it at all. And, you know, I spent an afternoon with it and I just came into his office and I said, Jonathan, this is a fabulous book. You know, and so he looked at it and he said, yes, indeed it was, which was everyone's reaction. So it was a kind of one of those weird success stories.
Well, in a lot of ways, that book does fit the aesthetic of Jargon in terms of Jonathan's interest and your interest in outsider art.
Yes, and also that period of the late 80s, Jonathan had... really, the outsider stuff had become a big influence, and not some. Well, there was the Saint Ohm book. I think that's the great outside. That was a little earlier. Also, he had sort of taken upon himself to publish Southern photographers. So there was this, for the first time, really in the press's existence, it had accepted its geographical position. In the South. And it's somewhat done that in England by publishing Simon Cutts and Raymond Moore, the photographer, who didn't really publish but took over a title that and distributed it in this country rather than the UK. So I think really White Trash Cooking, again, just the first volume, really makes sense in the list, as it were.
Yeah, no, I think it does, but it does stand out in some ways.
Yeah, well, it stands by itself. It's one of those extraordinary books where it just, you know, it's you know, it doesn't have a past and it doesn't have a future. Right. It just sort of like pops out at you.
And of course, I remember that we were sued by the Junior League of Charleston, South Carolina, because some of the recipes that Ernie Mickler had collected, he did not realize, as he'd gotten them from his mother, I think, was that she had copied them out of a Junior League cookbook.
Yeah, there were actually two suits that were brought, that were settled out of court. There was the one with the Charleston Junior League, and also the woman who appears on the cover.
Right.
She sued. There were settlements in both cases.
Because I think in that case, Ernie had not gotten...
Fortunately for Jargon, because of the terms of the contract, we weren't responsible. Though there is a point at which everyone becomes responsible, or used to be, the person who publishes the book, the person who distributes the book, the person who sells the book. So none of that happened. It's just that Ten Speed had the book at that point when these suits came in. And they decided that there was, in both instances, there was no way that any kind of legal action, any court or jury situation or judge situation would favor a sort of hippie, drug-crazed hippie press in California over a southern poor white trash lady in the South or genteel ladies in Charleston. So they thought the best thing to do, their lawyers said, settle. Originally, I think they were asking for $3 million.
That's right. The woman on the cover, I remember that she was asking for a relatively incredible...
Yeah, it was the same amount that at the time Liberace's boyfriend was suing him in the Palimony suit.
Well, good company to be in.
That's right.
Legally.
You know, I was going to say also, sort of in the same area that is interesting is this, that phenomena in the mid-60s when suddenly the New York publishers were picking up a lot of poets, and certainly Black Mountain poets, who seemed unlikely maybe in the late 50s when Don Allen's anthology came out. At that time, which is almost impossible to conceive of now, I remember talking to, I can't remember, it was a woman who was an editor at Viking, who was the person who was interested in, you know, like decided that they wanted to publish Robert Kelly's novel, and they wanted to publish, I can't remember, Diane Wachowski, I think, was published by Viking. She was one of the earliest of that kind of crowd of people who got books. And she explained, she said, well, you know, these are really prestige items. These are really favors to the editor and make the press look good. And that even then, they're not making money off of these books. But it was that old world of publishing.
That's true, which does not, those favors, as and it's well put, I think, to call them favors, really almost don't exist anymore because there's no willingness to publish books that lose money that they know will lose money. I mean, they publish books that lose money not on purpose, but a book of poetry or, you know, short fiction by an unknown or a novel by an otherwise obscure poet, a literary novel to, for that matter, probably, you know, today, I don't think it's possible.
Well, I know what, I remember the formula was that, this is, you know, from the 40s, like Thomas Wolfe or even someone like Hemingway, the formula was you publish the first novel, nothing happens. You publish the second novel, there's a little bit of interest. You publish the third novel, there's some critical interest and a few sales. And then either that third or fourth novel, suddenly it gets some reviews in the New York Times and it starts selling copies. And that you create a support system until that's possible. So you deliberately lose money on two or three titles.
Yeah, it's an investment in the career. I think that's how a lot of publishers looked at it. It's almost like farming a new field. You know, you have to work it for a while before it produces. And I think that the patience to do that is certainly not not likely or plausible today.
Well, until the big corporate media people got involved with publishing, I guess that's in the late 70s. It really was, even in that period up until then, it really was a gentleman's game. And it was absolutely insane, the economics of it. I can remember talking to these people who were potential and sort of occasional Jargon patrons, very wealthy corporate people, like people at the Aspen Institute and those heads of corporations and junior heads of corporations that you would run into. And they all looked at publishing as an absolutely insane financial proposition. And of course, the thing that I suppose really killed publishing in the 70s was when the stock was taxed by the government. Until that point, you could have a warehouse full of books and that was not, you weren't taxed on that as whatever you call it, inventory.
Right. No, I remember that whole, there was a lot of
discussion. So that meant you had to pulp the thing if it didn't sell. And, you know, I remember those amazing figures. You would know by week three if the book was successful or not.
That's true. Well, this never applied to Jargon.
No, because of being a nonprofit, which was the great, and we still have an awful lot of books.
Now, where is, I mean, Jargon published, I think, 115 pieces. Not all were books. Quite a few were.
There are probably about, I think the actual physical books number, I think about 60 books, bound books. The other things were things like broadsides and folders and pamphlets.
And you mentioned the inventory. Where is the inventory now, and who's selling the books?
It's right here. Actually, what happened, I don't know whether you knew this or not, but what happened was 2 years ago, I turned Jargon over to its assets and its inventory and its name. I turned over to the Black Mountain College Museum and Art Center in Asheville, North Carolina. So they now distribute Jargon books, and in fact, they're going to publish things under the Jargon imprint, which I had originally not wanted to happen. I had thought that it should all be closed down, but then when this transfer of funds and inventory and assets, I guess is the word, to them, which were, you know, primarily just a lot of books, and the royalties from White Trash Cooking. After I sort of got involved in it, I thought, well, there's no reason to not let them use the imprint. They're using, I think the first thing that will come out will be an anthology of Black Mountain poets. And that makes good sense that Jargon be the imprint for that.
Oh, that's a great idea. I mean, Jargon is clearly most strongly identified, if any school, I suppose, would be Black Mountain.
Yeah, I was also going to say that when we were talking about that 1970s, that kind of switch where Jargon goes from its sort of 50s, 60s, Black Mountain Poets period, etc. 1969, 1970, Black Mountain became such a hot topic after having been a really obscure, experimental, out there, end of modernism institution and idea didn't really click with the zeitgeist at all. But in 1970, you suddenly had, you know, of course, the careers of people like Motherwell and Johns and Rauschenberg and Cage and Buckminster Fuller, all these sort of stellar figures. And so you had Vogue magazine wanting to do a feature on Black Mountain. And of course, Martin Duberman in 68 started the research for his book. I remember being in the autumn of 1968 with Jonathan in Princeton and sitting there for about 3 hours while Martin Duberman interviewed him for that Black Mountain book. And then when that came out, that whole Black Mountain explosion of interest, which was of no interest to Jonathan whatsoever, though, I mean, it was helpful, but, you know, it was one of those, like, why didn't you do something at the time, that impossible question.
So, I think, well, actually, by 1970, also, I think, well, when did Jonathan, and when did you together, when did you start going to England for part of the year?
1969.
Right. So did that increase your interest and connection in British poets and artists?
No, he had cultivated. Well, he had been very involved with Ian Hamilton Finlay, really almost before Finlay, when Finlay was kind of a conventional on the page poet. He had it's kind of broadside magazine called Poor Old Tired Horse. And Finlay had been very interested, this would be in the early 60s, had been very interested in American poetry, when people like, and kind of the short, pithy American poem. So he was very fond of Robert Creeley, and I think that's probably how Jonathan got involved. Lurie Niedecker, they published work by her, or he did, Finlay. So when Jonathan went to England for the first time, which was really to walk, he went there with his then partner, Ronald Johnson. And so on that occasion, he met met Finlay, but also met a lot of people in London. So, and he had run into Bunting, I think, before he went to England. I'm not sure, but Bunting was part of it. And it was Bunting who had, well, actually it was Kenneth Rexroth who had put him on to Mina Loy, though none of that happened in England. That was all, well, she was then living in Colorado, in the United States. But Bunting had been very interested in Laurie Niedecker. And I think that was, and of course Zukofsky had been as well. So I think the Niedecker connection came through them. But it was really through Ian Hamilton Finlay that he became involved with Simon Cutts and Stuart Mills, who were the, and then oddly enough, John Furnival, who was a British artist who illustrated some jargon books and brought very early broadsides, had someone living, he had a big ramshackled house then, ramshackled at the time in Gloucestershire, and had a lodger who turned out to be Thomas A. Clarke, not our American Tom Clarke, but English, the Scottish poet Thomas A. Clarke. So that that kind of stable of jargons, English or British authors, developed in the late 60s, early 70s, but had roots much a little bit earlier. And like I said, I think those were primarily Ian Hamilton Finlay, who really was, again, very much like Jonathan in that he was a great networker and sent out work and solicited work for that, his poor old tired horse, which was called Poth.
That was a great magazine and a great name for a magazine, probably yeah. One of the best ever. Although I still think Fuck You, a Magazine of the Arts,
is probably
the best. well, you brought up Laureen Niedecker, who, of course, is very important to me as well. And only through, I give credit completely to Jonathan for introducing me to her work. But that was around the time that he discovered her. I think he also must have had, I think he had some connection to Sid Corman as well, but you know.
Yes, because Corman would have published her by then too, I think.
I think so. And of course, she had a long history with Zukofsky going back many, many years. But did you go to Wisconsin to meet her? I think you did.
No, I never did. She, I think Jonathan, right before I met Jonathan, we met in 1968. He had just seen her. He was in the throes, as it were, of publishing T&G, the first Niedecker title. But she was a good example I think Joel Oppenheimer had the same experience. Jargon was infamous, which is really the case with small presses anyway, infamous for taking on a title and then going, in many cases, going for years without being able to sort of scrape up the money and get the production up and going. I think Oppenheimer waited 10, 12 years for Friends Just, I can't remember what it came out called, Friends and Lovers, Friends, oh, yeah. Just Friends, or something like that. So I know that she was, I now know, because you see her correspondence published elsewhere, that she was writing letters frantically to people wondering if this book was ever going to be published. And he was in the midst of that when I, in 68, 69. And she is one of the titles that received that initial support from the National Endowment for the Arts.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, yeah.
I do remember, I mean, I do know that I've read the same correspondence that you have, and she obviously was very worried.
Oh, yeah. And I also I know another instance of it was Bill Corbett in Boston mentioned, because what happened was with Mina Loy, Jonathan had set about editing Mina Loy's poetry with a young poet who he'd met in Colorado at the Aspen Institute. And they really were going at it, tongs, hammer and tongs, really sort of like brutally editing this. I was actually quite shocked myself when I saw what they were doing. And then when Joella Beyer, Herbert Beyer's wife, who was Mina Loy's daughter, saw, you know, compared one public, you know, the manuscript of a poem to what they had edited it down to, and they did this kind of modernist editing where you take about 10 lines out of 50 and make a little haiku-y sort of poem out of that. And so she was horrified. And it wasn't because for any aesthetic reason. She just felt like, well, what's going to happen when people see this poem of my mother's that was published in 1920, and then they see this version of it here? So that project went into limbo. And a couple years later, Roger Conover, who was then a student at Bowdoin, I think it was, wrote Jonathan a letter wondering about asking questions. And so it became apparent that he was the perfect person to do the editing. And so he took on that job. This is a sort of Shaggy Dog way of saying that. So that book floated around without much real, once the manuscript existed. And he had gone to Bill Corbett and said, do you think these guys are ever going to publish this book? Because if they're not, I'm going to try to find another publisher for it. So, but that was the story, I think, of small presses.
Well, yeah, and there were so many things that required being done to publish a book. Aside from the preparation of the manuscript, there was also the raising of the money.
Yeah, that book had some National Endowment support. But again, your National Endowment support, as I sort of vaguely remember, well, those first books, I think they paid generally for the whole book. But then, then the whole concept of matching funds came in, so you would have to do that as well. So it is, I really think it's extraordinary looking back on it, that Jargon existed for 60 years as, you know, without becoming a for-profit entity, and that it just did what it did. It kind of stopped because Jonathan sort of was winding down his sort of public life by the year 2000. So there's very little activity after 2000. And in fact, there were a couple projects that just never came to fruition. That he really would wanted to do, but I think he was at a point where he had just worn out his ability to solicit funds, really.
What are the books that he never finished? What are those? Do you remember?
The book that he really wanted to publish was C.A. Conrad's Frank Poems.
And has anybody published it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They were. Did you know that work at all?
I don't think I do.
And so they were, and it was very, you know, they were terrifically successful. So that was, again, a kind of unhappy situation in which CA was kind of strung along by, not really strung along, but felt like he was being strung along because, again, it was a matter of raising money. But a manuscript was edited, knocked into shape. An illustrator was found, illustrations were done, and then it just didn't happen. And I can't remember, someone has published it, because I know we sent, CA wanted a letter, which we sent a signed sort of document saying that this had, yes, indeed, it had been selected as a Jargon title, and he was disappointed. Because I presume because the press, he felt there would be some prestige of having it associated with Jargon. It's been published. I haven't, oddly enough, I haven't seen a copy of it. I sort of vaguely been in touch with him, but I've just never seen it.
And any others?
He wanted to do a book of Roger Manley's photographs.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
That never happened.
Yeah.
I don't think there were any other poetry books that he was had on his mind. And I know there was the Roger Manley's selection of Roger Manley's photographs, but I think that was about it. He had projects of his own that he was very equivocal about publishing work of his own. He went through a period of feeling very neglected, as all poets do, but very neglected in the 90s, the late 80s and into the 90s, and did a lot of self-publication of sort of rather nice, because of the desktop publishing revolution, books that were distributed privately, and maybe one or two of them were subscribed. I mean, people would, it was all really private, and it was not under the Jargon imprint, Qua imprint, and those for his own work. So he did have a third book of essays that he, again, I think was maybe really to the point of thinking maybe Jargon could publish that book. It hasn't been published. He also had a big book on outsider art, which was floating around from the mid 80s on, which looked like it would be published, but by the time it was being sort of shocked about, people had already started publishing their one outsider art book. So this was a compilation of Southern outsider art. And then he had a series of quote books that started with a very small selection of quotes and then became vast. I don't think he ever considered publishing those himself, but it again never got published.
And of all the books, and you said some of them are still, you know, some of them are still available in,
oh, yeah,
in print. Yeah. And when I post this interview, I will find the URL for that and I will put it in the listing so people can find the books if they're looking for them.
I think it's an Amazon marketplace for the Black Mountain College Museum.
All right. I'll find that.
Okay.
You know, the distribution of Jargon over the years was very various and changed a number of times, as I recall. You know, that's something we haven't talked about at all, but in the early years, I think it was mainly wandering around and selling books, as we talked about before, and also probably sending books to the few bookstores like City Lights and 8th Street and, what's the bookstore and the poetry bookstore in Cambridge?
Gordon Kearney?
Yeah.
And Grolier
Bookshop. And so I think there was probably a very small network that he sold books to directly by probably sending them books and waiting for money, which maybe didn't always come. But at some point, as I recall, he did start distributing through other entities.
Well, the first one was Jim Lowell in the Asphodel Bookstore.
Right.
They took on essentially the idea of distribution. So if someone said, where can I get a hold of a copy of this? And I think it was even that was published in some of those titles that's where you wrote to or you that's how you got a hold of the book. And then after Jim Lowell, I think, which was a big jump, was the small press distribution. Aperture Magazine became interested through Jonathan's sort of parallel activity in the world of photography, of kind of contemporary American art photography, qua art photography. And it was at that period that Michael Hoffman took over Aperture Magazine from Minor White, who remained as a kind of editor and eminence gris. But Michael, built an empire, started building an empire. And one of the things he wanted to do was to distribute things like Jargon books or Dick Higgins Something Else Press, this strata of really interesting. And the idea was, and I think it was a good idea, was that that these are things that they had a whole sales force. And this was something that a salesman could go around and show a bookstore, and the bookstore would have very, very little access or be able to even see or know that these things existed. And this also was the period in which the Appalachian Photographs of Doris Allman was published, and that was very successful. So it kind of gave a boost to this idea that it was possible to sell these books if they created a niche for them, as they say these days.
Right, and how long did that last?
Well, it started in about 60. Again, it's one of these. It's this sort of pivotal period in 1968-69, and I think that last. When did you start distributing Jargon books? I think you were the next.
Well, didn't Jonathan Green have them for a while though?
Was that before you?
I can't remember where that fit in. I think I took Inland Book Company came into existence about 1981, 82, and I think we took on Jargon at that point.
And I think you took it on. I think Jonathan Green comes after you.
I think that might be right. We had it for almost 15 years.
Okay.
And then things fell apart. Although there was that incredible, never to be forgotten, at least by me. We had books, Jargon, we had so many Jargon books that we had put them in a trailer, a storage trailer, parked in our parking lot because we just didn't have room for them inside the building. And somehow, we don't know how still, that something set them on fire. I don't know if you remember that, but then we had a big insurance claim. I think it was a boon to Jargon Society because we paid you for all of these books that were burned that would never have been sold because they were the sort of deep backlist titles that we had extra copies of probably at 20-year or 100-year supply.
And you know, the other sort of biblical moment was that when Jonathan Green took over the distribution, he had books warehoused, I think, outside Frankfurt, and the Kentucky River rose and washed away a significant number of Jargon books.
Well, so it is.
You have almost all of Tom Clark's book. I can't remember what that was called, little Thomas A. Clark book.
Right.
So there are titles that just, have almost no, don't exist because they were destroyed by fire or destroyed by water.
I know. It is biblical. And where are the locusts? Those come next.
That's right.
But I think, we've covered a lot of ground. I guess one question I have is, do you think, either for you or for Jonathan, do you feel that, because I remember that period, and there was that period where he felt his own work was neglected, but there was that kind of feeling that the work that Jargon did, aside from a few books that had really great public success, and it wasn't, I don't think that you or Jonathan felt like the books that were the regular books that Jargon was publishing needed to be sold in large quantities to be appreciated. But I think there was this sense that because Jargon had been around for so long, it was almost taken for granted in some, in literary circles in some sense, almost as if the newer publishers were getting more attention, and Jargon, because it had been there for so long, sometimes just was not appreciated. Am I right in saying that Jonathan felt that way?
I don't think he felt underappreciated really as a publisher. He was someone who really wanted, he was one of those people who wanted people to pay attention to him. But I don't think he really, really sincerely believed that he was underevaluated. I think he had a very clear sense of his impact on the culture he lived in. He wanted... it still hasn't happened, but he was cremated, but he wanted a plaque, and he wanted it to be, it was taken after Herbert Read's grave headstone, which was he wanted to be poet, publisher, photographer. And I think he genuinely felt he'd realized all three of those. So I think that there was a certain amount of slight depression and crabbiness about recognition, but I don't think he felt like Jargon hadn't been recognized. And I think you're absolutely right. I think part of what he felt was that Jargon had been around for so long that it occupied a place, and it didn't seem like you're surprised that someone's still alive, quite frankly.
No, exactly.
Because they've sort of moved into a period, into a phase of being legendary or storied or whatever the term
would
be.
Right, I think maybe the 50s and 60s publishing was so, by the time the 70s and 80s came along, that became canonical. And then what was neglected was the real work that was still going on, the real work of discovery and artistic. I mean, I think publishing... And I think you and Jonathan really carry that through, and that is that publishing is an artistic endeavor. It's as you just said, poet, publisher, photographer. The publisher is a creative role or a creative being in the way that Jargon was.
I think so, very much so. But, I think the other thing with Jonathan, I don't think he really regretted this. I think since he really did do exactly what he wanted to do, published exactly what he wanted to do, it's kind of like, I can't remember the film, but that Woody Allen thing is about, we like the early funny ones.
Right.
We like the early Black Mountain ones.
Right. Although I think that some of the, certainly publishing Laurie Niedecker, and doing what Jargon did to bring her to the world was an incredibly important thing, and actually was very significant.
In fact, in that case, Mina Loy a bit earlier as well, he felt a little ill-treated by the way Laurie Niedecker was taken up, and then Jargon was completely written out of the history of Niedecker's publishing. A part of that was this big Niedecker book was full of editorial errors and things like that. So that I think the now standard Niedecker selected or collected poems only mentions Jargon in a footnote, doesn't actually mention the complete Niedecker or whatever that, I can't remember what we called that.
From this condensery.
Big book. But I think again, that's just irritability, I think, in a way. I don't think that really got down to his confidence in the fact that he had made a mark, a very definite mark on American culture, which is something I think he really wanted to do, and he accomplished it.
Yeah, I think he did. Well, I mean, it's, I think if you look at the list of books that he published and the people... I would say to anyone listening to this, there will be names on that list that you will never have heard of, to this day, who are obscure, fugitive, difficult, cantankerous, unusual, people who did not play by the rules of literary culture. And that really, I think, is what marked Jonathan to me and you. I mean, I think it's both of you. To give voice to people who would simply be outside of all of what we expect in a literary culture.
Yes, I think, his interest late in the history of the publishing in outsider art was exactly what it had always been. So that someone like Laurie Niedecker, he's devoted to because of, well, the quality of the work, but the fact that there she is in Wisconsin. Of course, that was a world in which people wrote letters, and so she could be published by Coyote's Journal, and she could be published in Scotland by Ian Hamilton Finlay, and had a literary life that was spent writing letters. But that was very important to him. His feeling was, if you live in New York, someone will take care of you if you've got talent.
Right. He was more interested in the people that no one knew about who were living in the mountains of Georgia or, like an Alfred Starr Hamilton who lived in a rooming house in Montclair, New Jersey.
Yeah, the Alfred Starr Hamilton story is astounding now that that book has become so, the Song Cave book has become fantastically successful.
I know. I've started reading it, and I've read most of it. In fact, it's just unbelievable.
Because that's one of the books. That again was one of the National Endowment for the Arts. That first series of grants. That was, I think, it pretty much paid for that book as well.
Well, it was. You know, that is an indicator of, I think, Jonathan's incredible talent at discovering really excellent work that no one else had ever found.
And I think the thing that was really interesting about that process is that he really was very good at listening to what other people had to say to him. You know, I mean, so it would be a young poet saying, I have, you know, showing him those. It was Jeff Young. It's not Jeff Young.
Jeff Hewitt.
The fellow who was David Ray's student, who had worked with David Ray on the magazine and seen all those Alfred Starr Hamilton poems.
Right. Jeff Hewitt.
And I think maybe it is Jeff Young. I can't, anyway.
No, it's Jeff Hewitt.
Jeff Hewitt, yes, in Vermont, right. Yeah. And so, and you know, like Rexroth suggesting Denise Levertov, like Rexroth was a good source at the very beginning. Mina Loy, he told Jonathan, he would say things like, which would pique Jonathan's interest. He'd say, oh, you know, there's this fantastic figure, Mina Loy, from the 20s in Paris. And you know what? She's still alive and she's living in Aspen, Colorado. You know, it was one of the, so it was all that sort of weird thing. Or Alfred Starr Hamilton, who was such a kind of curious figure apart from the poems he wrote as well, living in that boarding house in Montclair, New Jersey. And that it was his peripatetic nature as he'd get in the car and visit these people.
I know, it's great to imagine him doing those things. Well, Tom, it's been wonderful talking to you. I really appreciate you giving me an hour to talk about Jargon Society and your involvement and Jonathan Williams. I really appreciate it. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the book industry. We've been talking to Tom Meyer, the poet, who lives mostly in North Carolina, but part of the time in England as well.